I think I'm going to invite Marcy Ray more often. Either that, or I'm going to include the word sex or opera more often in my brown bags. So thanks for coming. My name is John Beck, and I co-direct Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives, which is a joint effort of the Labor Education Program of the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations and the Traditional Arts Program here at the MSU Museum, and has been for 20 years. This is actually, actually 21 years. We're going into the 20th year of the Brown Bag series next year. And sometime next fall, we'll have the 200th Brown Bag. And for the 150th, we had a cake, so I'm not sure what we'll do for the 200th, but we'll do something special. Maybe champagne, you know, who knows what kind of stuff we'll do. But I'm going to just announce a couple of things that next Friday, week from tomorrow, Rebecca Muniak is in from the Ecology Center at the University of Michigan to talk about her work, which is on Brazilian coffee workers. It's called Labor, Livelihoods, and Brazilian Black Gold, Navigating Fair Trade, Coffee Quality, and Environmental Standards. So that'll be quite interesting. So let me actually just start passing those around, so do come back. Then a few days after that, Maria Katera will be in, also from Ann Arbor, but from American Studies and Women's Studies over at U of M, and she'll be here talking about Working for Justice, Legacies of Latina Activism in Southeastern Michigan. Maria's talk in February got snowed out. You might remember that big snowstorm that hit, and so we're very happy that we were able to reschedule her, so do come. And then last but not least, please do look at the bottom of this for our remaining two brown bags in April before we close down for the summer break. And so we look forward to having you come to those. Any and all other wonderful things we have going on. We do exhibits, film openings, poetry and fiction readings, this brown bag series exhibits. And we currently have a very, very fine exhibit that has a wonderful group of work-related photos in it, which is our Seeing China exhibit on the first floor. So do check that out if you haven't spent time in it. It is absolutely captivating. So do turn out. And keep those sign-in sheets circulating so we can figure out who y'all are. And it's great to be able to tell people that we had a great audience from Marcy Ray. Now, Marcy, I've always found Marcy to be a force of nature anytime I've been around her. And I've been trying to get her into this brown bag series for years, right? And she would say, well, what about this topic or what about that topic? Finally, we were talking recently and about her work on French comic opera, and specifically that a lot of French comic opera really turns on issues of class and gender and other kinds of things. And I said, yes, finally we have a way to bring Marcy into the series. So today she'll be helping us. She's an ethnomusicologist and everything else, historian over at the College of Music here at Michigan State. And today her topic is love, sex, and greed, reflecting gender and class in French comic opera. So please help me in giving a warm welcome to Marcy Ray.
Thank you very much for being here. I know that these are talks, and disciplinarily we write talks and we read from papers, and so I know that that might be a little boring, but I promise to make it as entertaining as I can while I read. The thought of having to deliver my research without the safety net of my notes is absolutely frightening, so I'll try to do what I can to make it as much like a talk and less like a paper as possible. In 21st century America, we generally love a good rags-to-riches story. In early 18th century France, however, this was the stuff of aristocratic nightmares. Although it was in this era in France that that gave us some of our most iconic stories in this vein, including Cinderella, which I have a picture of, it was these kinds of social transformations, these kinds of auspicious fates that were really reserved for only ideal young women whose virtue was tested at practically every turn. These were not meant to be the fates or destinies of wily servants or manipulative flirts, but these are the people we'll be talking about today. The nobility had every reason to be anxious. Over the course of the 16th and 17th century, monarchs had begun consolidating their authority. So whereas noble lords had once considered themselves rulers of their own territories, their independent authority began to slip from their grasp. After the mid-century civil war known as the Fronde, Louis XIV exiled some of his most rebellious subjects and required others to live under his close surveillance at the Palace of Versailles. And so hopefully, yeah, this is Louis crushes the Fronde. So there's a rebellious courtier right underneath his foot. To keep up appearances at court, so now they're all living with him, and so anytime he traveled to one of his other castles, they all had to pack up and move around with him. This was so he could keep them under his watchful eye. To keep up at court, though, the nobility drained their inherited wealth on the latest fashions, while also wasting it away and relieving their boredom at the king's gambling tables. Here's a contemporary engraving of that. So the Seconde Chambre des Appartements, this is at Versailles, they're playing cards. At least one contemporary, the Duc de Saint-Simon, felt that the king encouraged such reckless spending to keep his nobility in helpless submission. At the same time, a rival nobility had developed, the noblesse de robe, or the nobility of the robe. Unlike the nobility of the sword, the noblesse d'épée, who inherited their status, the nobility of the robe essentially paid for it by purchasing a position in the government in a government office. And while this position could also be hereditary, the noble title was attached to the job and not the person. So with their long-standing rank at stake, the nobility began to come up with other means to distinguish between their social group and their inferiors. The aristocracy attempted to set themselves apart with refined manners and language. Nevertheless, the fear that the social ranks were becoming indistinguishable remained palpable. This talk explores the most threatening rags-to-riches story, that in which the villain insinuates him or herself into the upper echelons of society. It is a tale of money, sex, greed, and social ambition. This particular story begins in the period known as the Regency, after Louis XIV's death in 1715. At this point, few lamented the death of the king. Rather, shortly after the aged monarch's passing, French men and women began airing their grievances in popular songs and memoirs of the late king's reign. One song circulating at the time claimed that, like the Messiah, the monarch had died for the good of the world. Indeed, he left France on the verge of financial ruin. One of the first measures the regent, his grandson actually, took in an effort to reinstill confidence in the French crown was to establish a chamber of justice. Here's the edict. A temporary court authorized primarily to extract money from corrupt and scandalously wealthy royal financiers to help replenish the national treasury, which had been drained after two decades of war. Its secondary goal was to penalize some of the most notorious financiers to appease the public outcry against these men, who both collected and dispersed royal monies, often at usurious rates. In the popular mind, the financier had become an accomplice in Louis XIV's reign and the failures of his reign. By the time of the Regency, the corrupt royal creditor not only was a popular figure in satirical song, but also the French stage and comedies. Theatrical portraits of financiers were overwhelmingly negative, although not entirely so. In general, dramatists mythologized the financier as a man of humble origins. Usually, they claimed that he was a valet, and who he amassed wealth without mercy or scruple. Let's see if I can find. So this is the agioteur, that's another name for the financier, who is elevated by fortune to the highest degree of richness and abundance. So there he is reclining on a couch. Here are financiers waiting to come up to fortune and accept their new fates. So he might be violent also, typically in comedies, he's very violent, as we'll see in one of the comedies that I'll talk about, and with libertine inclinations. So he's very promiscuous, kind of a lady killer. Comedies typically ensue with this lackey turned financier attempts to appear well-versed in polite manners or the subtleties of the fine arts, but blunders miserably. And this, of course, would have been delicious to the aristocracy who wanted to see that he was nothing like them. Despite his great wealth, French dramatists made clear that the financier was not to be mistaken for high society. In addition to satires about the financier's avarice and low origins, literature, songs, and comedies also began to express growing fears about greed and social decay in French society at large. French men and women increasingly believed that the financiers were the root cause of burgeoning social corruption. One songwriter had already linked agiotage, and that's trading paper money for coin or vice versa, for the breakdown of relationships between men and women, claiming that money drew people together, not love. Others wrote that financiers were poor examples for women. They taught bourgeois ladies to crave extravagant lifestyles. One contemporary engraving celebrates the fall of the financier's mistresses. So here, what you'll see is these are apparently mistresses of financiers. They're walking up to fortune, and then as they walk down, the god of fortune snatches away all their jewelry and so forth upon his fishing line. And at the bottom it says, weep, you unhappy ladies, weep, you prey of financiers. Like this engraving, the Forains, the writers, musicians, and actors at the Parisian theater known as the Opéra Comique, often conflated fears about the combination of fiscal and social corruption. Several Opéra Comiques in this era articulate growing consternation about how the greed associated with the financier infected contemporary social life, merging in particularly with anxieties about female sexuality. The connection between depictions of the financier and the coquette is what this essay proposes to examine. These characters bring together a number of early modern anxieties about love, wealth, gender, and class. In particular, as the visible boundaries between the aristocracy and the wealthy bourgeois became less clear, society needed someone to blame, and these particularly upward mobile characters were made perfect. They made perfect scapegoats. To do this, I examined two opéra comiques that premiered on the same bill in the very month that the regent established the Chamber of Justice. The first comedy, Arlequin Traitant, Arlequin Financier, explicitly comments on the current tribunal that investigated the wrongdoings of financiers. The second, Les Arrêts de l'Amour, or Cupid's Judicial Decisions, features court cases, but here it is the coquette that is on trial. Like this engraving here, the dramatists at the Opéra Comique felt that financiers and coquettes were two sides of the same coin, pun intended. However, unlike most literature about coquettes in this era, the Opéra Comique is far more sympathetic to them. And unlike this engraving, in Opéra Comique, they are rarely stripped of what they procured from their suitors. The financier, on the other hand, always loses upon the Opéra Comique stage. He was a villain for which sympathy could not be mustered. Nevertheless, both became vilified for how they acquired wealth, their voracious appetites for money, their vanity, their immorality, and their sexuality. The last decades of King Louis XIV's reign had been fraught with disaster. His last two military campaigns, the Wars of the Grand Alliance and the Spanish Succession, resulted in devastating military setbacks and left the national treasury in crippling debt. Coupled with famine and disease that racked France in 1693 and 94, and then again in 1709 and 1710, as well as wartime taxation, French men and women were starving and ready for change. In a time of fiscal problems, the financier became a familiar target. They had considerable power, both real and imagined, since they collected, handled, or dispersed royal monies. Indeed, public credit was almost entirely in their hands. They were also the middlemen between the crown's financial backers, members of the nobility, and the national treasury. And as intermediaries, they deflected anger from the nobility, who were also complicit in the abuses of the system. Financiers acquired their wealth through the fees that they charged the king, as well as the businesses that they conducted on the side. He had become a particular satirical target earlier in the previous century, but after Louis XIV's death, however, some French subjects began to hope that after the king's long reign, the long reign of the financier would also be over. Calls for their defeat were both written into song and dramatized on stage. Popular songs known as Pont Neuf, for instance, juxtaposed financiers' lavish lifestyles with widespread poverty crippling most of France. Several songs called for the financiers to be hanged, and another dared to imagine. Okay. The treacherous financiers are no longer in favor. Clearly they still were, but this is hopeful. These hideous monsters again become beggars. So note that they again become beggars because they were thought to totally unsubstantiated. They were thought to come from the lowest classes. Loaded with devalued paper money, they will henceforth in these places be the last of their race. So as the regent is establishing his chamber of justice, they were really hoping that this was the end. When the regent established this chamber of justice, such outcries only intensified. The regent established the tribunal primarily to redress the national debt, but if in the meantime it punished financiers and alleviated the public outcry against them, then so much the better. It also served to bolster the regent's new authority over the kingdom. Some of the problems that the regent needed to address, along with the staggering national debt, were heavy taxation, late payments to troops and office holders, and scarce coinage. And although royal notes might have alleviated some of the problems of the scarcity of specie, their value plummeted since people feared imminent bankruptcy. And sorry for the crude image. I found it yesterday, and it's fantastic. So what this gentleman are doing up here is feeding coin into the guy's mouth, and he is essentially defecating paper money. And so that's what they thought was happening. And so that's how they thought they were going to alleviate the paper, the debt, was to change coinage, which was actually still made of silver and gold in this period, and transfer it to paper money. Unfortunately, since 1704, almost all royal payments had been made in paper. By the regency, these paper notes were practically useless. The regent then declared that all paper money should be brought to a special commission that they installed in the Louvre to be verified and converted into a new note. This process was called a visa, and it reduced the crown's short-term debt by two-thirds. Meanwhile, a royal decree raised the value of specie, specifically the gold louis d'or and the silver écu. These methods of debt alleviation were nothing new, but unfortunately, it made specie even scarcer. Amidst this financial crisis, financiers felt particular pressure. Those who collected the tithe, or the primary tax, the direct tax, felt it first. They were asked to present their accounts to the Council of Finance. But the Council of Finance was very lenient, so they granted them many delays, and eventually no one turned in any money. The council then created a special commission to review all fiscal contracts. Furthermore, property that financiers had transferred to wives and children were now subject to scrutiny and even seizure and sale if necessary. So what financiers typically tried to do was hide all their money, saying, oh, it's my wife's. No problem, right? It's my child. But then they kind of caught on and were trying to seize that as well. So at first, these investigations produced much-needed monies. But panic began to spread among the financiers who feared the Chamber of Justice. They began hiding specie, only increasing its scarcity, and the mounting pressure on them pushed some of them to bankruptcy. The problems with punishing too many financiers, however, was that it could spell the disaster of the state, since they were basically in charge of the treasury. Dramatists staged these anxieties at the Opéra Comique. For instance, shortly after the regent authorized the Chamber of Justice, Jacques-Philippe d'Orneval produced Arlequin Traitant. Okay. And it satirized the corrupt financier and a conventional marriage plot. The Parfait brothers, contemporary chroniclers of Parisian theater, noted that this opera comique was composed to commemorate these events, and they noted that it actually referred to specific financiers, which was much to the light of the audience. Indeed, the Commedia dell'arte love plot that the opera comique employed was easily adaptable to the financier, to make the financier the villain. So in this story, both the father and the financier attempt to thwart the traditional union between the stock lovers. So over and over again, they use the same characters. So Isabelle and Leandra are often the main kind of upper bourgeois or aristocratic lovers. And there's always some obstacle. And so here, that obstacle will be the financier. So the doctor has promised his daughter to the wealthy financier, but Isabel is not really excited about it because she likes Leandra. So here, Arlequin is chosen. Arlequin is the stock clown figure in these shows. So over and over again, you'll see Arlequin in disguises and various ridiculous postures. He's cast here as a financier. So people already know, okay, he's doomed to fail in the most comical way. And so people would have been really excited about that. So what they did was take Arlequin, the stock clown's traditional features, and combine them with those of the financier. So, you know, the financier was most recognizable for his greed, vanity, immorality, deception, and they combined them with the traditional characteristics of Arlequin, who was known for his wiliness, his cowardice, and his clumsy manners. So, Arlequin was considered a lower class character also, so there was never a chance for him to marry Isabel. That just never would have happened. So people already knew, and they just wanted to see in what ways he would fail comically. So although in this opera, Arlequin narrowly escapes the clutches of a demon, which we see here, and tortures awaiting him in the underworld, he cannot elude the royal archers. Once the archers march Arlequin off to prison, Leandra and Isabel pledge their love, an act that crystallizes a new society in the absence of the perfidious financier. The larger issues that Arlequin Traitant treats is newly commercialized social relations and class anxieties with regard to the nouveau riche, or these newly titled bourgeois. The first issue is largely expressed in the tension between the doctor's financial goals and Isabel's emotional needs and her desire to marry Leandra. Although the 18th century marks a turn towards sentimental marriages, and indeed this is the period that we say that modern marriage, where you get to marry someone you like, this is when it begins, but in the aristocracy that never happened. So parents often wed their 12-year-old daughters to 60-year-old men because men didn't inherit their wealth until their fathers had died, but they needed to produce an heir, so they turned out their 12-year-old daughters to old men, and so there was hardly any real love there. This is going to put that in some tension. So parents had been arranging their children's marriages to protect their assets because you didn't want it sort of going into the wrong hands and to acquire greater wealth and higher social status. So you wanted to marry someone equal or better to you than your social standing. But over the course of the previous century, as the coffers of the nobility dwindled and merchant classes amassed large fortunes, some parents agreed to what they called misalliances or mixed marriages. And the mixture here is of status. Here, we can see that money motivates the doctor's choice. For example, in the first scene, Leandra complains to Isabel's servant that the doctor has chosen Arlequin to be his son-in-law. He observes that without a career in finance, Arlequin would still be a valet, which plays on the popular but unsubstantiated notion that they come from the low class. Leandra and the servant Colombine sing their dialogue to a popular tune called The Fool Who Wants to Be Clever. So all of these shows were, they didn't use new music typically, they just used popular songs. So in choosing The Fool Who Wants to Be Clever, they're clearly playing, they're satirizing the financier. So Leandra, our stock lover characters, asks of the servant, does he ignore his social status? Does he not know that he was once a valet, that this rascal without a career in finance still would be? And the servant answers, that's what I told him. He responded, Leandra, who has moved you, comes from a better family, I agree, but I prefer a person with more money. So, furthermore, the characters in the opera also lament parental control over marriages. So over the course of the last century, marriage laws had strengthened parental authority over choosing mates for their children, which had hardened basically centuries of custom into law. The lovers disparage these laws a number of times over the course of this opéra comique. In the first scene, the servant Colombine tells Leandra that Isabel curses the cruel laws that are going to cause her misfortune. At the beginning of Act 3, Isabel, alone on stage, sings a song designed to elicit pity for her predicament. She sings that the birds don't have to worry about such severe laws. Everyone there in that beautiful retreat is free. The effect of these critiques of contemporary marriage laws was to condemn parents who chose spouses for their children based on wealth and status rather than their children's preferences. Thus, even before he appears on stage, the financier is already marginalized from the social order that the two stock lover characters represent. The audience then could predict the outcome of the plot and eagerly awaited his delicious downfall. The librettist, Dorneval, exaggerated the portrait of the financier to bolster the idea that he must be expelled by the end of the show. Several aspects of his portrait point to the anxieties about social status. When we first meet Arlequin, he appears richly clothed in expensive fabrics, and he carries a pipe encrusted with jewels. His upper crust fashion is not matched, however, by his noble bearing. He treats his many servants poorly, even grabbing one of them by the neck. He alludes to the contemporary Chamber of Justice and suggests that in these state of affairs, he needs to get rid of his servants to conserve his wealth. So what he decides to do was basically pick a fight so that they'll all leave and he doesn't have to pay them. But he retains one of them, and he claims that he will make a gentleman of this servant. So retelling the story, his own story, through this new servant. He tells the servant, Transparent, that money makes one beautiful, cultured, and even affords one the air of a fine birth. It also helps to woo the ladies. So he sings the following song. Do you want a cruel lady to respond to your ardor, or the husband of a beautiful woman to cease complaining? Accompany your love with this cherished metal, coin. It makes the wife speak and the husband silent. Excited by these prospects, Transparent exclaims, Vive l'argent, or long live money. In another scene, Arlequin attempts to hide his humble origins by purchasing forged documents and a coat of arms to suggest that he is of noble birth. The coat of arms features a golden mushroom sprouting out of sand upon a black background. The mushroom refers to the old French proverb, he grew up all in one night like a mushroom, which in this case quickly signifies that the bearer of these arms has only recently acquired his wealth and that it stands upon shifting sands. Arlequin likes the image, but he refuses the backgrounds, claiming that it is villainous black. The maker of the seal, Mr. Blazonnet, goes on to suggest that the motto of his arms should read, Virtuti debita merces, which translates roughly to wealth won by force. When Arlequin squabbles over the price for these papers and coat of arms, Blazonnet complains that he had to work very hard to falsify these records for him, since the dirtier the laundry, the harder it is to clean. Arlequin then resorts to violence, beating him with his bat. When Arlequin finally interacts with Isabelle in scene 9, the audience already knows that he is an inappropriate match for the heroine. But romantic scenes reveal more about the financier's flaws. For example, he speaks in conventional comic language of financiers. He attempts to woo Isabelle using metaphors of money. You will, my beautiful mistress, receive on this happy day all the products of my tenderness in the lockbox of your heart. That was a kind of safe. He goes on to promise Isabelle that he will provide for her very well, and that they shall shine in courtly society. People will mistake them for members of the aristocracy, and this, of course, pleases the doctor immensely. Isabelle, however, is less impressed and begs her father for a 6-month delay before their wedding. She clearly thinks that the contemporary tribunal will either severely undermine Arlequin's reputation or that he will be punished. The doctor will not hear of it and demands an immediate wedding in his country home. In the end, the royal archers come to take Arlequin away before he can marry Isabelle. He eludes them for a moment, but ultimately he cannot escape them. After Arlequin's arrest, the doctor finally consents to the union between Isabelle and Leandra. This Arlequin triton ends with the dawn of a new society without the villainous financier. This opera comique, therefore, seems largely optimistic about the outcomes of the recently established Chamber of Justice. On trial at the same time, both in literature, engravings, and at the opera comique, was the coquette. She was, in many respects, thought to be just like the financier. She, too, acquired her wealth at the expense of others and was thought to be heartless, immoral, and a narcissist. While 17th century writers set out to define the various characteristics of the coquette, vanity, of course, was one of her central features. In his Caractères from 1688, Jean de la Bruyère claims that a coquette is a woman who never yields to the passion she has for pleasing, nor to the good opinion she entertains of her own beauty. Vanity, he argues, is her predominant feature. Fickleness, of course, is also associated with the coquette. Such a flirt easily grants or refuses affection, and she will turn her attentions to whichever suitor grants her the most favors. But as La Bruyère notes, when a woman no longer cares for one man, she forgets all the favors he granted her. The Forain also exploited general fears about the conflation of financial and sexual license, making connections between women and financiers. Alain-René Lesage and Dorneval depict the women of their comedy, these such women in their comedy, Les Arrêts de l'Amour. These women engage in fiscal schemes of their own, taking money and lavish gifts from lovers to from that to establishing a gambling den to extract money once their beauty no longer attracts rich suitors. They harvest as much wealth as they can to feed their appetites for lavish lifestyles. Furthermore, like the anti-financier literature that claimed that financiers built their wealth upon the misery of others, the women of Les Arrêts de l'Amour established their own richly adorned lives upon the ruin of their suitors. This comedy premiered soon after Arlequin Traitant, thus strengthening its connection to contemporary events. It stages a courtroom where Cupid, sort of seen here, presides over his own court of justice, counseled by Themis, the Greek goddess of law, divine order, and custom. From his throne in his own chamber of justice, Cupid he gives counsel to lovers in need. Les Arrêts' scene mocks quarrels involving generally ridiculed figures, including lusty widows, flirtatious and unfaithful actresses, and lawyers. Indeed, audiences may have seen Les Arrêts de l'Amour as a series of comical lovers' quarrels. But it also can be read as conflating fears about fiscal corruption with broader apprehensions about female guile and general social decay, explored through the breakdown of romantic relationships. Ultimately, Les Arrêts de l'Amour uses romantic problems to delineate a world run by greed with little hope for justice. Indeed, in Cupid's carnivalesque court, he celebrates rampant financial and sexual promiscuity. Several aspects of this opera comique allude to the contemporary chamber of justice. Aside from the proximity to the events themselves, Lesage and Dorneval modeled Les Arrêts de l'Amour on legal literature that published contemporary case law. So, people had begun reading contemporary case law in literature called Les Arrêts. So the fact that this is called Les Arrêts de l'Amour is alluding to that. So they were expecting imminently that these Les Arrêts were going to be coming out of the Chamber of Justice, and they would read them. And they were hoping to read basically all the, you know, trials and tribulations of financiers and their punishment. So this is much like this. So this opera comique features a series of scenes. So it's basically a number of scenes with different lovers coming in to quarrel before Cupid. In the final verses of this opera, so the whole time it's just been dealing with lovers' quarrels, but the very final verses actually allude to the financier, saying that if the financier came before Cupid's court, he would fail miserably. So that kind of provides some context for understanding the rest of the show. So while Les Arrêts de l'Amour's plot about lovers' quarrels does not seem transparently related to the Chamber of Justice, it is connected to a moment in the previous opera that we just talked about, Arlequin Traitant, which patently is about this tribunal. In Act Two of Arlequin Traitant, when the financier has been dragged to the underworld by a demon, he makes a tour of his new home. He finds that early modern villains have replaced such iconic figures of the underworld as Tantalus and Sisyphus. The Danaides, for example, were condemned to spend eternity carrying water in a sieve, a task that could, of course, never be completed for murdering their husbands on their wedding night. According to Arlequin's demon guide, the women of Paris have taken their place. Here are the women of Paris, who, to provide for their expenses, reduced their lovers to a most terrible poverty without ever having enough. Like these women, the ladies of Les Arrêts de l'Amour all extract money and luxury items from their lovers, pushing some of them to the point of financial ruin. Yet, unlike contemporary engravings and songs that long for the destruction of financiers and their mistresses, in all but one case, Cupid favors the greedy women. For instance, he recommends that two women, one young and one old, join together to combat loneliness and to enrich themselves by exploiting men in a gambling den. Furthermore, when an actress explains that she keeps several suitors to maintain a steady stream of gifts and money, Cupid decides that she should keep those gifts, despite the protest of a jealous lover. Only in the last case does Cupid order Isabel to marry the poorer of two men from whom she extracted gifts. Less out of condemnation for her behavior and more as a point of comedy, Cupid makes her marry the lover she ruined with her expensive tastes. Cupid's overall leniency in the Arrêts de l'amour towards these money-hungry women reflects two fears. First, it expresses the suspicion that the Chamber of Justice would fail to punish financiers. Indeed, French subjects had reason to be cynical about this tribunal. The ruin of royal financiers imperiled the state, since they provided income for the national treasury, but these men were also conduits between the monarchy and its creditors, who were often members of the church and the nobility. And therefore, they acquired pretty powerful protectors. By one count, two-thirds of the Parliament of Paris was related to financiers by marriage or interest. So the very people who were meant to judge them were related to them. So they had reason to be cynical. Furthermore, as past experience had shown, few financiers had ever been severely punished. In Les Arrêts de l'amour, Cupid likewise hardly punishes these fiscally minded women and even encourages their schemes to dispense affection for material rewards. Thus, such coquettes are similar to financiers because they both acquire wealth in what contemporaries regarded as immoral avenues. Ultimately, what we might learn from portraits of the financier and the coquette is that they were linked by their greed and their vanity, which drove their social ambitions and which contemporaries worried might unravel the social fabric. Not only were they squeezing people dry of money, but through advantageous marriages, they were insinuating themselves into good families. From family to the state was not such a large leap, since jurists since the 16th century onwards had mapped the relationship of the king to his subjects in family metaphors. He was, in these terms, France's head of household. Thus, what was at stake was the stability of France itself. The writers at the Opéra Comique, however, were fairly optimistic about the country's ability to survive the financier's treachery and even encouraged the coquette's vanity. They could never have anticipated, though, the fate of the coquette in the coming decades. Her chief success story is, of course, Jeanne-Antoinette Poisson, a daughter of a financier, who eventually became the king's mistress and was then renamed Madame de Pompadour. It was an unprecedented alliance. Although kings had long well-known mistresses, all have been carefully selected from the nobility. So indeed, as at the Opera Comique, the coquette, born of the dreaded financier, emerged victorious, even in real life. Thank you.
Well, you know, great. I've got thousands of questions, and probably other people do too. So let me open it up. Questions or comments? Well, let me hit you with one for starters, which is the Inquisition had made Jews in Portugal and Spain into what were known as New Christians. So often the financier in other images is often the Jewish moneylender. Is there a certain amount of that in this literature of the opera at all with really bringing the religious element or the ethnic element of Jews into the opera as well?
It's a good question. Yeah, so I mean, for a long time, Christians were prevented from moneylending and so forth, just Christianity kind of outlawed it. So by default, then Jews were the ones doing it. In these comedies, there doesn't seem to be this whiff of anti-Semitism. But there is a kind of, I mean, the fact that the financier is always Arlequin, who wore a black mask, there might be some allusions to some ethnic differences. But there doesn't seem any specific religious context for understanding these characters. But it is a good question.
Okay, David?
Have a sort of cultural politics that came into play in some way in the French
Yeah, these are both good questions. So the Opéra Comique was actually two theaters, one near what the Gare L'Est is today in Paris, so up north, and then one in the Saint-Germain district. And they were fairground theaters. So they were in the context of like animal acts and acrobatics and selling coffee for the first time and liqueurs and things like that. So and they were cheap. They were cheap tickets. So people claimed, critics claimed, oh, this is just for the great unwashed, you know. But the truth of the matter is, even though they like to claim that because of the sort of immoral subjects that they offered, the king, for instance, could be seen at these shows. The nobility were regularly in attendance. But because they claimed it was for the lower classes, they could kind of get away with being there. So, and I do think that these shows play a very large role in politics of the era because they're often, you know, I mean, it's carnivalesque. So always Arlequin is outwitting, or servants are outwitting their masters. And so over time, I think this does have an effect. But by the time we get to the revolution, this theater actually closes in 1745. Isn't reopened until 1752, and then it's sort of sentimental bourgeois comedies. So what happens is the kind of ferment that gets developed here goes underground into like pornographic literature and salacious literature and sort of more political things that have to be printed in Holland and then brought back. Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? Let me, you know, I'm really struck by this last opera you were talking about in relation to Cupid, because Cupid, of course, is a pagan god,
yes,
right? And the interesting thing is just the difference between the Greek and the Roman. On the one side, we get Cupid, and on the other side, we get Eros. You know? So this is a time, as you're really laying out, both of changing moral standards, perhaps, and changing love standards,
yes,
right? So, I mean, it's interesting that there... Two sides of the same coin, in effect, in this. So, to a great degree, are these very, in your mind, strong moralistic kind of things, in effect, that where people ultimately get what they deserve? That is, the financier gets what he deserves, but we drag people back down, kind of thing. The coquettes, is it because of their overall, is it their greed on the one side? Or is it really that the kind of loose women notion that really drags them down? Which, I mean, how does that all figure in?
Well, women almost always win at the Opéra Comique, so it's really the financier. He was just a villain across the board. I've just finished a book on these operas and women, and this was really the only place where women could win, because if you go to the opéra, the official tradition, basically what you see is women having to capitulate and having, Cupid becomes actually pretty oppressive there. He basically says, you got to get married and I'm sorry you don't want to. And they have no choice in the tragic operas of who they marry. And so it's much more like real life. Here they, you know, beginning in the 1680s, women get to choose. And so it's very progressive in terms of love.
Well, but let me just ask you about that, because women have always had greater amount of choice in lower classes.
Yes.
Okay, so that it's only really in the nobility or upper classes where arranged marriages. I mean, I don't think that they're as common within the lower classes, where it's simply often a question at this time, at least, of coupling, and therefore, you know, often getting married after the fact, so to speak. So, is it? I mean, is that class dimension in this?
Yes, because the Isabel and Leandra are always of the upper class. So so it was pretty progressive. And of course, novels had developed in the mid 17th century France, written by aristocratic women who basically redesigned love, saying, you know, my heroine is going to get married for love or not at all. And so there was a kind of revolution already started about choosing one's mate instead of having parents choose for you.
Okay. Other questions? John.
Thank you so much for your talk. I was thinking about Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
Something or someone he's not is already very prominent much earlier in Britain. that he's exploiting people, but that he's a peasant who pretends to be someone he's not.
Right.
And I find it interesting that the audience maybe is upper class people who are scared that they are the unwashed who get away with pretending that they are part of the upper class, which they're not. And then you said that Ali Khan is always a stock figure, so in the opera you know immediately who it is. You don't have to worry about being fooled and tricked, because there it's much easier to laugh if you're not scared about, you know, being fooled. I wonder if that, I don't know, those were my very amateurish thoughts.
No, that's great. Yeah, so, I mean, the tradition that this French opera comique is based on is the Commedia dell'arte. So the Commedia dell'arte has all these stock figures, Harlequin and all of the same figures. And they've been, Italian troops have been traveling to France beginning in the 16th century through the 17th century, and eventually Louis XIV establishes his own Italian troupe. And so then it was an aristocratic tradition. So people would go and see these shows, and it was thought to be all in good fun. But then they had the audacity to have a thinly veiled farce on his second consort. So you really couldn't make fun of the mistress so explicitly. So he exiled them, and this French troupe took over their repertoire and started sort of adapting it to their needs. So for a while, this had actually been aristocratic entertainment. But once it was put in the French language, it was somewhat more dangerous. So they never received any official patronage from the king. He had given official monies and titles and privileges to the other theaters, but these got none. So essentially, they were—they couldn't speak, they couldn't sing, they couldn't use any of the artistic properties. So what they did was just steal them. So they put on these productions, but they were closed down, their theaters were burned down, they chopped up the theater. They did all kinds of things to try to get these people not to perform these shows, but they did so anyway. So, like, for instance, if they couldn't speak at a certain time, they would like walk on stage and pull out a placard that said their words, and then they'd walk off, and then, you know, they'd pull another one out. Or if they couldn't sing at the time, all of these were well-known tunes, so they would just have the instrumentalists, like they do kind of at church, like play the first verse and then have everyone sing, and they'd have little children dressed as cherubs sort of bring down the words of the song above the stage and stuff like that. So definitely there's like a political element, but yes, I think there is some safety in knowing that Arlequin will never really get away with anything. The problem, of course, is that women do. And so one of the things that I trace is the sort of destiny of the coquette over about a 100-year period. And so here she gets to succeed, but when she's put on stage at the Royal Theater, she's regularly condemned, humiliated, made to look so foolish in front of an aristocratic audience. So clearly they were afraid of something if they kept basically murdering her on the stage before an aristocratic audience. So there was something going on here that they needed to repress, clearly.
I'm interested, you started off the talk by talking a little bit about the whole notion of people being able to get what they now have because of occupational title.
Yes.
That is that they in effect now had title to something even though they were not quote unquote noble by birth.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. So there's this whole tension between birth on the one side and perhaps occupation. And were a lot of those occupations filled in effect, and roles filled by people who actually were able to do it because of the fact that they were simply given title then.
Yeah.
In effect, they were not necessarily competent in terms of what they were trying to do.
No, they could they basically could afford to buy the position.
Right. Okay.
So they could afford to buy it, and so a noble title might be conferred, and so that's what they were doing. They were basically buying their way into the nobility, and there was great tension. So, real nobility, you had to have four generations or more of nobility, and so if you bought it, you were really considered lower class. But there was a group of women who invited. They had salons, and they invited this mixed set of nobility and gave them all the tools they needed to succeed at court. So there was this shadow court going on outside of the court in which women were basically training these new nobles how to get by. And so that was also very troubling.
Well, but it's interesting, too, because, I mean, I automatically thought of the Wolf of Wall Street or whatever in relation to your talk, that we still have a strong moralistic bent against financiers if we believe that they're coming by their money, you know, in some nefarious way, right? But on the flip, I mean, the American capitalist kind of little nugget is, if you're so smart, why ain't you rich? You know, so I mean, it's interesting. In this case, it's, if you're so rich, why ain't you noble, or whatever, right?
Yeah, and that's the problem with this rags to riches story. Like, they couldn't have appreciated it. Whereas now we think it's based on merit. You earned this. You worked so hard and you earned it. And that there was no meritocracy in the French aristocracy. Like, that's not what they thought. You were given this birth by divine grace, and that was the only way you could acquire it.
Well, and Paris Hilton perhaps becomes a coquette in this opera, right?
Absolutely. Okay. We have many coquettes. I mean, this is sort of a long-standing thing, right? I mean, anytime a male politician has some secret lover, we automatically assume she slept her way to the top. Or any time a woman wants to grasp at power, then we assume that she slept her way there. So sexuality and power, we still worry about that.
Well, and it's also related to women who work. I mean, you know, we call coquettes and prostitutes working girls.
Right.
You know, so by its very nature, it has that kind of other class aspect to it.
Right, but they weren't worried about those women because they weren't marrying into the upper class the way the coquettes were.
Right. Okay, any other questions? Yes, back here, Michael.
Yeah, there's a couple of different ways that they use tunes. So, for instance, they often stole tunes from Lully, the main opera composer's operas at the time. So one of the things that they did was, there was a song from one of his operas called Les Trembleurs, The Tremblers, and it was people in cold climates, you know, trembling, and so you have, you know, like really agitated string melodies or whatever. But what they would do is take that song for angry characters who are, you know, really raging or whatever, or they'd do it when someone's laughing so hard or whatever. So they would take a tune that had maybe a different context, but the music of it sounded like it could fit different things. But then from Les Arrêts de l'Amour, they had a scene between a lawyer and his wife, and the lawyer's complaining that his wife is spending all his money. But what they do is choose tunes that completely undermine his rhetoric. So they choose a song called Les Feuillantines, which was originally condemning a man whose wife was, you know, had lots of lovers and acquired all this money from her lovers, and he bundled her off to a convent. So when the character, the lawyer character, sings this song, he's basically becoming a contemporary figure of ridicule. So they're conflating that story with an older one. So there are numbers of different ways in which they use tunes, but often it refers back to an older situation in which that tune might have been used. Yeah.
Okay, other questions, back over here.
Besides acting, was there any role of women in the production of these shows?
Yeah, so actually, I mean, across the board, so in both the Opéra Comique troupes and at the National Theater, the Comédie Française, which still exists, it was purely democratic. So actually, women had shared power with the men of the troupe. And so they decided what new actors they would allow in, they decided the repertoire, they decided, you know, which artists' work they were going to mount, and so forth. So in that way, that was completely new and progressive. But because they were actors, they were denied a Catholic burial. So there were many other problems of being an actor in this period. So you might acquire some equality, and you might acquire some fame, and maybe some really rich lovers, but in the end, you were going to die without, you know, the sacraments. So in a Catholic society, that amounted to a lot.
Okay, other questions? Well, why don't we give Marcy another round of applause? What a wonderful time. So come back next Friday to hear about coffee in Brazil. Come back the following Monday to hear about Latina activism in southeastern Michigan. Do sign in if you haven't, and we look forward to seeing you at future Our Daily Work, Our Daily Life events.